This is an ABC podcast.
Hello and welcome to The World Today. I'm Sally Sara. This Friday, just over a week from Election Day, the Prime Minister admits he's got his faults but begs voters not to break up with him. And Australia's Sheldon Riley has made it through to the Eurovision final. He's got the costume and music with a message.
Sheldon's entry is more likely to appeal to a diverse audience because it is not just about sexuality. Sheldon's story is about him, you know, being gay and also having Asperger's syndrome.
First up today, emergency alerts are ringing out once again across southeast Queensland as waters rise across a vast area. A severe weather system has dumped heavy rain into already sodden catchments. Brisbane's Lord Mayor has warned that low-lying parts of the city may flood again. But the major area of concern is west of Brisbane, where residents of the town of Laidley are moving to higher ground after a creek burst its banks. And further west, the Lockyer Valley is on high alert. There's no let up in sight. The rain continues to fall and the area can expect another 100 millimetres. Rachel Mealy reports.
It's now all too familiar for southeast Queensland.
Well, it's still raining at the moment at the head of Mulgowie Creek, and the flood mitigation dam is full from rain previously this year. So the street's slowly filling up with water and it's coming in like little waves, about 3 or 4 centimetres. Every like 10 minutes you get like another wave of water that comes through and it's slowly creeping up the main street.
Brad Mann lives in Laidley, west of Brisbane. He's been helping friends and locals move their belongings to higher ground yet again.
But a lot of residents are prepared. The main street's been like taped up and sandbagged and that. But some of the businesses are getting inundated by water at the moment.
What sorts of businesses have been affected so far?
One of the lawyers' things, and I'd say the produce that's further down near Narda Lagoon that's flooded at the moment, that'd have water through there. And the fruit and veggie shop that's in the main street, it'd have water in the front of that. And it was just creeping up to the news agency at the moment. And one of the old pubs on the corner had water in it too.
Brad's mother, Kathy Mann, lives further west in Grantham, where emergency sirens were activated early today. And people who live in low-lying areas were warned to relocate to higher ground.
You know, last time we had it, you could see it all over the farms and we could see the Lockyer Creek from here. Yeah, it went down a bit overnight and it's not as high as it was yesterday. But if we get more rain, which they're saying we will, it'll be worse.
Queensland's Premier Anastasia Palaszczuk is urging residents to be alert, but says overall the flood risk isn't as bad as last time.
We are not expecting to see that extent of damage that we saw last time. But as it's an evolving situation, we are asking people to be prepared and to be alert.
Bureau of Meteorology senior forecaster Laura Bokel says the rain is still falling and there's now a risk that all that water will cause some minor flooding when it hits Brisbane's creeks and river.
One thing to note with Brisbane is that while we have minor flood levels in the river, it's the creeks as well around the Brisbane area that are responding very rapidly to a lot less rainfall. So we don't need to see a lot of rainfall to see rises in the creeks. And where we do see those intense pockets of rainfall, that's when we can start to see flash flooding.
The State Emergency Service says it's had 300 calls for assistance overnight. Most of them were because of leaky roofs, but there were some swift water rescues. Glenn Alderton is the acting director of the Queensland SES.
If you flooded earlier in the year, make sure you have some preparations in relation to your emergency plans. And should the rainfall continue as we think it will, you may need to activate those plans.
There's also been some flooding in Ipswich, Gympie and Beaudesert. Further west, the Condamine River is rising and residents of Milmerran are on alert. A bridge in the town of Warwick has been closed because of rising floodwaters there.
That's Rachel Mealy reporting. So why has there been so much rainfall on the eastern seaboard and when will it stop? Professor Andy Pittman is director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes.
Anyone who's living on the eastern seaboard would be quite familiar with the fact the rainfall has been extraordinary A number of records have been broken. This isn't a typical event, as everybody, I think, would understand. It has been extremely wet.
Why is it happening?
So first and foremost, it's because the air is flowing from the east over very warm oceans. Those oceans are warmer than they used to be. The oceans have been warmed by global warming, and warmer oceans pump energy and moisture into the atmosphere. So the air, which is also warmer because of global warming, is carrying more moisture. But there's a lot more to it than that. That sets up the conditions for the extreme rainfall, but you need uplift. You need the air to be moved vertically upwards. That's much more complicated. And so what we've been seeing are things like East Coast lows or small features associated with vertical uplift forming. And those feed all the way back to how the Southern Ocean is behaving and the whole setup of the meteorology over the East Coast. We can't link that with global warming. So we know there are attributes of these events caused by global warming, but there's others that are almost certainly natural variability, and they're all interwoven.
So those underlying factors are there. Why is this happening? Why is this event happening right now?
So it's not an event. It's a sequence of events that are occurring kind of sequentially. And so a lot of that is just bad luck. A lot of it's natural variability, but it's natural variability exacerbated by the fact the oceans have been heated up and the atmosphere's been heated up, so there's more moisture to fall.
How long will this keep going for, do we know?
So the particular set of circumstances are linked in with La Nina, and some of the predictions for the next 6 months around La Nina suggest what's called a triple dip La Nina, which is not unprecedented but is quite rare. Others are suggesting it's all breaking down and we should move back to normal conditions. It's too early to be sure. So there is a risk that this will carry on for some time, but there's also a hope that it's beginning to break down and things might become more normal.
We often hear in weather reports about La Niña and El Niño. Can you just remind people again the difference between those two?
So in terms of people's lived experience, on average, La Niña brings above average rain to the Queensland and New South Wales regions and Southeast Australia, whereas La Niña tends to bring well below average rain on the East Coast. And it's all to do with ocean temperatures in the Pacific and the way that those interweave with weather patterns. But the simple rule of thumb is La Niña tends to bring below average and La Niña brings above average rain.
That's Professor Andy Pittman there, the director of the ARC Centre of Excellence for Climate Extremes. Let's go to federal politics now, and just a week out from the election, with polls suggesting a change of government could be on the cards, the Prime Minister has made a rare concession. He's admitted he can be a bit of a bulldozer and has promised to change his style if voters re-elect him for another term. Our reporter David Lipson joins me now with more. David, it's quite an admission from the PM. Does this suggest he's a bit worried?
Yeah, Sally, good afternoon. I think this is significant. It's not a change in policy, but it is a significant change in strategy and rhetoric in the dying week of, or the dying days, if you like, of the campaign. We have, of course, known for a long time that Scott Morrison isn't personally popular, particularly with women. The coalition strategy, though, up until now has essentially been it's better to stick with the devil you know. That they said things like you don't have to like your dentist as long as you know that they're competent. A kind of Brussels sprouts are good for you strategy. Well, this change today tells us that strategy isn't working and the coalition is worried. So a major change in tack here, and as I say, all just a week out from polling day, the Prime Minister claiming today that the pandemic and the challenging national security environment required strength over the last few years, but that things are looking more hopeful in the future and that he's prepared to change if voters give him another chance. Take a listen.
What have Australians have needed from me going through this pandemic has been strength and resilience. Now, I admit that hasn't enabled Australians to see a lot of other gears in the way I work. And I know Australians know that I can be a bit of a bulldozer when it comes to issues, and I suspect you guys know that too. As we go into this next period, on the other side of this election, I know there are things that are going to have to change with the way I do things, because we're moving into a different time.
So, you know, pretty rare to see such sort of self-reflection, if you like, this close to the election. The risk, I suppose, here is that it'll be seen by some as desperation. And certainly the opposition hasn't missed a beat in jumping right on top of this. Here's Anthony Albanese.
A bulldozer wrecks things. A bulldozer knocks things over. I'm a builder. That's what I am. And if I'm elected Prime Minister, I'll build things in this country. This government have been there for almost a decade. This Prime Minister has 4 years in office, and what he's saying is, if you vote for Scott Morrison, I'll change. That's what he's saying. Vote for me and I'll change. Well, if you want change, change the government.
That's the Labor leader, Anthony Albanese, there. David Lipson, the government has also shifted its lines on the minimum wage debate. What's happened?
Yeah, there's been a few shifts on this week. It follows Anthony Albanese's proclaimed support for a 5.1% pay rise for minimum wage workers. The Prime Minister at the time claimed that that was reckless. He talked about the damage that could be done to small business who'd have to pay those increased wages and the damage that could be done to the economy as a whole. But in the days that followed, Labor tried to portray Scott Morrison as being against higher wages, and I think they had some success in doing that, rightly or wrongly. Now the campaign spokeswoman for the coalition, Anne Ruston, is saying, well, the Prime Minister was actually never against an increase of 5% for the lowest paid workers. Here she was.
The government has been very clear in its condemnation of the comments by Mr. Albanese, not because of the figure that he put out there specifically, but the fact that he's just chosen to put a figure out there, you know, without bothering to consult, take advice.
So we saw Labor reposition on this in the days after that statement from Mr. Albanese, claiming that it wasn't actually an official party position, that they wouldn't actually submit a case for a 5.1% increase to Fair Work Australia. Now the government is shifting on this too.
And David Lipson, thank you very much. That's our reporter David Lipson summing up the latest on the federal election campaign. Well, Central Queensland could be an important battleground this election, where Labor is looking to regain support it lost last time. The seats of Flynn and Hinkler are now held by the LNP with a large margin. But political leanings in these electorates can be volatile and local issues are complex. Our reporter John Daly has been travelling through the region and I spoke to him a short time ago. John, good afternoon. Why is Central Queensland just so important in this election?
Hi, Sally. Well, remember, these seats of Flynn, Capricornia and Hinkler in Central Queensland were once marginal. Now, that all changed last election. Labor's support among the working class communities in these seats collapsed. And now they're held by the LNP at quite large margins, like 14.5% in Hinkler, 8.7% in Flynn and 12.4% in Capricornia. Now, Labor has declared Flynn, which covers the industrial towns of Gladstone and Emerald, as winnable. It's a little bit more complex in Hinkler because it centres on the local mayor, Jack Dempsey, running as an independent as well. It won't be an easy task for Labor to regain the support of these blue-collar towns because the coalition's economic argument does have an impact here that from the people I talk to. But Labor's focus on wages and the cost of living is also proving popular. So I guess it's the question of whether Labor's political momentum is going to be enough to undo its losses in the last election.
John, you've been speaking with a lot of voters. What are the issues that keep coming up again and again?
Well, first and foremost, the hip pocket. Jobs, rising rates and rents, fuel and food costs are factoring into a lot of people's minds when they head to the polls. Now, I visited Gladstone and Bundaberg and a lot of communities in between over the last few days, and voters at the pre-polls had this to say.
Mate, it's got to be Labor. We need to fix this government, mate. We need to fix their wages, mate. So,
is it wage growth for you?
Oh, it is, mate. The cost of living is absolute bullshit, mate. So, yeah.
I voted for the Morrison group at the moment.
What matters to you in this election?
Matters to me is we should do something about the unemployed just sitting around getting paid extra money that they did get paid when the hard-earned working person was still working and not getting that extra money.
Who did you vote for today?
Pauline Hanson's One Nation.
And were you a coalition voter before you started voting One Nation?
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. What did the coalition do to lose you?
They didn't stand up for us. So when the states put in mandates about vaccinations and masks and all the rest of it, and they should have stood up to the premiers and made sure that we had our freedoms.
That's some voters there getting ready to cast their ballots early. And John Daly, who are people expecting to win?
It seems the LNP are the favourites here to hold ground in central Queensland, if not for a correction with some of those large margins tightening and perhaps becoming marginal again. But look, underlying issues like availability and affordability of housing and healthcare could work in Labor's favour. And another big factor that people not necessarily have thought about is the influence of Pauline Hanson and Clive Palmer's parties. One Nation and the United Australia Party actually poll really well in these central Queensland seats, and they're on track to maintain that influence, if not grow it. Now, last election, they picked up 20% of the combined vote in Hinkler, which centres on Bundaberg, and nearly 25% in Flynn. So if it's a tight race, which some expect it will be, both are preferencing the LNP over Labor on their how-to-vote cards. And if this race is tight, as some are expecting, those preferences could make a big difference.
John Daly. The Northern Territory's Labor government has this morning chosen a new chief minister to replace Michael Gunner. The party has announced Natasha Files as the new leader. I spoke a short time ago to our reporter in Darwin, Jane Barden. Jane, good afternoon. Was Labor's choice of Natasha Files as the next chief minister, was that expected?
Well, the outgoing Chief Minister, Michael Gunner, had anointed his deputy, Nicole Manison, from his right faction of the party, whereas Natasha Files is from the left, and both those women had put their hands up. Natasha Files was born in Darwin, and she was a former PE teacher before getting elected as the Gunner government took office in 2016. And she served in the Gunner government as the Attorney General and the Health Minister, and particularly her management of the COVID response in the territory, keeping the virus out for so long and really minimising the number of deaths here, made her popular with the public. And Michael Gunner was very aware of that. He'd attempted to clip her wings by demoting her out of the Attorney General portfolio in 2020. But ultimately today, Labour's left faction have just done the vote and had the numbers to install Ms. Files.
And Jane, what does this mean for the direction of the NT government? And of course, we've got a federal election campaign underway. What are the implications for Labor's federal candidates?
Well, Michael Gunner's government has really prioritised economic development, and they've been very gung-ho about particularly developing a new onshore gas industry in the territory. And that's really angered many in the community because Labor was originally elected giving the impression that they would ban gas fracking. So Natasha Files' side of the party, the left faction, has been much more cautious about allowing that industry to start up. So it'll be interesting to see there whether there is a lot more caution and perhaps a lot more less speed in terms of trying to get some of those big projects up. Also, Michael Gunner's government has been very vulnerable to attacks from the Country Liberals' opposition over its management of rising crime in the territory, and that's really become a key issue in the federal campaign as well, which has really been tough for Labour's candidates in the marginal seats of Solomon and Lingyari. So the party's decision not to pick Michael Gunner's chosen successor and to pick Natasha Files is really might be seen as a decoupling from that management, and that could basically help Labour's federal candidates, Marion Scrimgeour and Lingyari and Luke Gosling and Solomon, against the CLP's Tina McFarlane and Damien Ryan.
That's Jane Barden. An Electrify Everything advocacy organisation has launched an online tool that calculates how much households could save if they switched over to electricity in their homes. But just how feasible is it? Catherine Gregory reports.
Sydney homeowner Kate Brandon really started feeling the pinch of her energy bills a couple of years ago.
When we started to work from home particularly, and that was through COVID, you know, our energy bills went up significantly.
Not satisfied, she took matters into her own hands and started electrifying her house.
Switching it over to solar and then also switching our appliances, so even our heating over to electricity for the daytime meant that it would be, you know, in effect paying for all of that for free from the solar and not having to draw it from the grid and having to pay for the kilowatts coming through.
Kate Brandon says she's now saving about $100 a quarter, $400 a year, and that's worth the upfront investment of $8,000 to install the solar panels, which also included the rebates offered by the federal government.
So I think the estimate was around about 10 years, but with the electricity going up in price and just how we're running, I think we might make that back in 5 to 6 years.
Those sorts of savings is what advocacy group Rewiring Australia is aiming to highlight. It's launched a new online tool that allows people to see how much they could gain financially by electrifying their homes. Dr. Saul Griffith is the founder of Rewiring Australia.
You can type in your postcode or your electorate and it will show you what the average household in that postcode or electorate will save if they, over the coming decade, swap out all their cars for electric vehicles, swap out their water heater for electric heat pump water heating, and power a good portion of that with solar on their roof and some solar in their communities, but also from the renewables that are hitting the grid right now at a lower price than gas and coal.
Saul Griffith says that tool also shows how much a suburb or community would save collectively, as well as how many jobs it would generate for tradespeople.
Community savings added up is to emphasise the opportunity for economic renewal in our suburbs and in our towns.
So obviously it all sounds great, but so many households are going to say, well, we can't afford to just suddenly electrify everything. Electric cars are still expensive. Installing solar still has quite a significant initial cost.
So what we're really saying is if we electrify all of these 100 million machines over the next 10 years, as they're going to be replaced anyway, that's what is going to drive the savings. And Australia, curiously, has done the best job in the world of one critical piece of climate policy, and we just need to apply that to everything.
And what's that?
10 years ago, all of those households would have said, nah, solar's too expensive. But through good program of rebates and subsidies and of tariffs, get that electricity purchase back on the grid, we've now got the cheapest electricity in the world on our rooftop.
The plan has the support of other energy experts too. Professor Andrew Blakers is from the Australian National University.
The cost of solar electricity from your roof is about a quarter of the retail tariff.
Of course, but for people it's still a significant initial outlay to put solar on their roof.
There are low interest loans. $5,000 or $6,000 is vastly less than somebody buying a car, and you get your money back in 2-3 years.
That report from Catherine Gregory. Finally today, love it or hate it, the world's largest music competition, Eurovision, is underway in the Italian city of Turin. And just a few hours ago, Australia's entrant, Sheldon Riley, qualified for the grand final. Carly Williams reports.
Wearing 40 kilos of feathers, a crystal mask and a white corset, Aussie Sheldon Riley belted out his Eurovision song about looking different as he charmed the crowd at the competition's semi-finals in Italy. In front of thousands at the Palace Sport Olimpico in the Italian city of Turin and millions more watching around the world, the 23-year-old won the hearts and minds of the judges with his song Not The Same.
I just made it. I can't believe this is happening. I'm so grateful. I'm so thankful. Watch the grand final, I guess.
Sheldon Riley lives in Melbourne and is the first unsigned singer to represent Australia in the Eurovision Song Contest. Growing up on the Gold Coast, Sheldon Riley's conservative family weren't initially supportive of his sexuality and told him to, quote, pray away the gay. Dean Vuletic, historian of contemporary Europe and professor at the University of Vienna, is in Italy watching the event live.
Talks about diversity and difference. Sheldon's entry is more likely to appeal to a diverse audience because it is not just about sexuality. Sheldon's story is about him, you know, being gay and also having Asperger's syndrome.
Sheldon Riley is one of 25 who will compete in the grand final on Sunday morning Australian time. Ukraine has also made it through. Eurovision has always claimed to be apolitical, but it's not always been the case. And this year's event is set to be more politically charged than ever.
Of course, the biggest political message is that Ukraine is in Eurovision and Russia is not. And the European Broadcasting Union came to this decision one day after the Russian invasion of Ukraine.
So, who will win? Dr. Jess Carnell is Senior Researcher in Humanities at the University of Southern Queensland.
Unfortunately, I don't think Sheldon is in with a chance, and that's nothing against his performance or the song. It is just going to be quite a tight run between Ukraine, Sweden, and surprisingly, the UK.
While Ukraine may be one of the favourites, Dean Vuletic predicts it'll be a close call.
everyone is asking me, will Ukraine win this? Especially because the voting in Eurovision is based 50% on public voting, but also 50% on musical quality. I wouldn't be sure that Ukraine would win, but what I can say is that Ukraine has already won the battle for Eurovision because it's represented in the contest this year and Russia is not.
That's Dean Vuletic, a professor from the University of Vienna, and that report on Eurovision from Carly Williams. Well, that's all from the World Today team for this week. The program's producer is Mike Edwards. Associate producer is Barney Porter. And technical production from David Sargent and Anna John. We'll be back again at the same time on Monday. I'm Sally Sarah. Have a great weekend.
Hey, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. Donald Trump lost to Joe Biden a year and a half ago, but the former president's hold on his Republican Party seems to be stronger than ever. Today, political analyst and author Jeffrey Cabaservis on what drives Donald Trump and why the world should prepare for his return. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.